I'm James Cheney. I'm going to talk about some joint work with Paul Anderson in Edinburgh on provenance-based security for configuration languages. So what is a configuration language? So configuration management is the problem of, so a lot of us are at universities, you know, maybe your department has 100 or 500 or some large number of machines, and your department computing staff don't want to go around to each machine and change its configuration locally. That's the same in many large organizations. So the problem is to keep your large set of machines upgraded and maintained over time. Is the, yeah, you can see that, okay. And for example, to keep them configured in a way that you know, has firewalls and other services set up correctly so that you don't have security problems. And increasingly, people use declarative high-level languages for configuration where you have a centralized file or repository, and you set the configurations on that, and then you push a button and things get propagated to the other systems. So this is better for maintainability. One example of this kind of system is LCFG that was developed in Edinburgh by Paul originally. And there are other popular languages, one of which is called Puppet, and there are some more. So I anticipate that there may be people in the audience that know a lot more about this area than I do. I'm not an expert on configuration languages, so please forgive me if I get it wrong, but that's my understanding of the rough idea. So you want to have a kind of high-level declarative language that says something about each machine in your network, in your organization, and deploy the configuration to each machine. So this is one way of doing it, but obviously the problem is that then it's slightly better than having you know, all the configuration embedded in each machine so that you have to go to it physically to set it up, but there are still problems. There's a lot of redundancy because each machine has its own kind of huge configuration file. And there's a lot of overlap between, for example, you know, all the desktops might have very similar configurations and servers that play a particular role might have a lot of similarity. So the smarter way that languages like LCFG and Puppet support is to compile these large but somewhat redundant configurations from a library of more or less standard things that maybe are specific to your site or to particular groups of machines. And then for each particular machine, you might have something that provides the things that are specific to that. So, you know, the IP address and particular things that are special to that machine. So the amount of code you need to maintain to deal with any particular machine is much smaller. And the amount of code you need to change to make a kind of across-the-board change, you know, you just need to change one of the higher level configuration files. So maybe for a lot of people familiar with this problem, this is old hat, but I just wanted to explain it in case, like me, in case there are people that haven't seen this before. Okay, so, and then an important observation that is relevant to the rest of the talk is that these kind of higher level configuration files are a bit, I keep hitting the side of the speaker there, so the laser pointer is a little bit useless. The higher level configuration files might come from a variety of different people. Your organization might have 10 or 20 people that are writing separate configuration files within the organization, and there might be generic ones that you get from manufacturers or from a third party that you don't necessarily have any control of that are coming in. And they're all kind of being combined and compiled into these configurations that go out to your machines, okay? So why is this important? Well, here's a quote that hopefully illustrates why this is important. So to summarize, people use this in air traffic control. So even if every component in the Linux-based system being used for air traffic control were perfectly secure, for example, if you have problems with if there are vulnerabilities in the configuration management system being used to configure it, then all bets are off. So that's one example. But so more generally, the point is that bad configuration management can lead to vulnerabilities in the overall system, even if the individual components are secure. And this is particularly problematic because the configurations are often maintained distributed across sites or across different people's machines within the same site. Maybe within a particular site, all put into a subversion repository or something, but controlled by different people and then combined into the configuration files that are being being built. So there's a potential for either mistakes, honest mistakes in the configuration file, or malicious exploitation to negatively affect the behavior of the overall system. So if the system's misconfigured, it goes down, things break, people get upset, people lose money. All right, so really, I want to say up front, this is a talk about the problem and not about a solution. So I want to give an extended example that shows how this can be bad. I suppose I should speak up to drown out the people next door. So here's an example, and I want to, the example also, I think, I want to illustrate why some unusual features of configuration languages complicate the problem. So here's the example. So we have, this is Puppet syntax, right, this thing over here is Puppet syntax that says there's a kind of server called a generic server, and it has a time server field, and you know, when this is deployed, this means that the system gets configured with this time server. Okay. And this is being provided by some third-party provider of configurations. And our company called widget.com this is importing this configuration from config.com. So we have a kind of site sysadmin, Bob, who takes this and specializes it with some other information, it doesn't matter what, for the purpose of the example. And so there's a kind of feature of Puppet that's essentially kind of a data or prototype-based inheritance feature. So class really means a class of data values rather than a Java class. It's not, there aren't methods, just fields, okay? Okay, so there's a specific kind of widget server that's a generic server, and there's a specific kind of sales server that's a widget server, and at each point, the different people involved, Carol is a kind of group sysadmin in the sales department. At each point, people are adding lots of configuration parameters, and I'm not showing any of them to keep the slide small. And then finally, Dave is a kind of sysadmin that is in charge of a particular machine, and he sets the IP field to be 1234. And so then we push the button and build the configuration for this machine, and push the deploy button, and everything runs, and everybody's happy. Okay? But so the point is, these are just two parameters out of, you know, maybe hundreds. So keeping track of changes to these configurations is not necessarily easy to do just by manual inspection. All right, so then one day, Carol wakes up and says, I want to play with this configuration and try a local time server. So she sets this field to make a temporary change. And then meanwhile, unbeknownst, because they're not, you know, they're in different organizations that don't even know each other, Alice makes a change to the configuration, and this gets imported into widget.com's configuration because things get upgraded. So Alice changes the default to another time server value that happens to be not a good one for widget.com. Flaky network routing between here and there, I guess, or something. Okay, but things are fine still because Carol's time server change has masked Alice's because it came later on in the specialization or in the inheritance chain. Okay, so everybody's still happy, everything still runs. And then the next day, Carol says, okay, I'm done with my local test. I'm going to revert. So everything should still be fine, right? Because it worked yesterday before I made the change, so it should still work. No, that's not what happens, because now the change is no longer masked, and the change made by Alice yesterday goes through and becomes part of probably part of all of the configurations, but at least this important server's configuration. And because it's not a good time server for this configuration, everything grinds to a halt, and everybody's unhappy. So since Carol made the most recent change, it's obviously her fault, right? Yes. Yeah.
And clearly, you know, my responsibility is that I should be, you know, pulling or updating or whatever the metaphor is. So is this different? If so, why?
Is this different? Well, so all of these things are under source code control. They're in different repositories, and then we're building the configuration from whatever the current version is of each one.
Right, but that would seem that I shouldn't, when I'm done with my temporary change, my protocol needs to be
Well, this red file, okay, so I mean, that's one way of dealing with this, is to remember the version of remember the versions of each file that you use to build. The red thing is not stored anywhere. It's built and then deployed and then forgotten. That's not version controlled. The components are version controlled. So you could, and that's, you know, that's, I think, not one of the things we talked about in the paper, but you could say, okay, we're going to, well, you know, so the answer obviously is provenance, right? So one form of provenance could be, you know, for each build, right, say, record the versions of the underlying files that you use to build it, and then when you get a version, you know, when the current version, when you have this problem, right, the current version breaks, you say, well, look at the version that didn't break and see what the underlying versions were and see which changes in those versions might be, right? So that would make it clearer that the reason for the break is Alice and not Carol, because Carol's change didn't affect, you know, reverting Carol's change reveals that Alice made a change, right? So this is a somewhat naive example, and there are more complicated examples. But yeah, that without version control, obviously, the answer is you better start using version control. And I didn't explain that clearly. Okay? Right, so this is bad because Carol didn't do anything wrong. So here are two other possible workarounds that besides the kind of maybe naive version control based approach. But even I claim these aren't necessarily good workarounds, even if you are versioning everything also. So you could validate each configuration as it's produced. So this would at least tell you when something bad is about to happen before it happens. So you could use a whitelist that says which time servers are good. But it would not help you identify the cause of the problem unless you had some kind of validation on steroids that validates each configuration independently. But since it's not clear that, you know, Alice did anything wrong either, because her change, maybe it was a good change for a lot of people, but not for widget.com, it's not clear that that's what you want. Also, if the validation is automated, then the system could get into a stuck state where, so, you know, I make a change and then you make a change, and now I can't revert my change because your change would leads to a break in validation, and so it's not clear what's wrong, or how to revert things. Another possibility that has been explored in a research paper recently is to impose some access control on the system. To check whenever a change is made that the final result doesn't break the configuration or doesn't do something that the person making the change to the underlying source files isn't allowed to do to the final configuration. So that's sort of helpful, but controlling it only can, the previous work on this only controls the effects of changes on the final product, not on the underlying configuration files. So the assumption is if it's my file, then I'm allowed to do whatever I want to it. But if the result of that change leads to a break in the final configuration, or leads to a change to a part of the final configuration that I'm not allowed to change, then that's forbidden. And the problem with that also is that you could get a similar issue with being stuck or inversion of privilege, where I make a change that I'm allowed to make because somebody else has already done something that masks my change from the final configuration, and then when they go to try and make a change that maybe unmasks my change, they're not allowed to do it suddenly, even though they have higher privileges than I do to make other kinds of changes. So, or they do have the privileges, and then they get the blame for the change that I made in some sense. Okay, so I want to argue that there's something maybe at least that I haven't seen much about before about this kind of inheritance or method of compiling essentially declarative information from different sources in maybe an ordered way that suggests that maybe we should take that into account when we do this, when we try to control access or validate. And so as I said before, the reason I'm here is that the idea is going to be to try to track provenance through this compilation process in order to understand how information's flowed, as Deepak was talking about before. And the starting point, of course, is, well, you know, if you have any idea of what you're doing at all, you really ought to be versioning at least the basic source files. And so you get a basic, although not perfect, form of provenance tracking based on the line level annotations of who SVN thinks made the most recent change to each line. And you can use that as a starting point, at least to audit the results, to have something that hopefully gives you a useful starting point to figure out why who's responsible for a change, or perhaps to impose some kind of access control to make it impossible to make a change that even potentially leads to changing something that you shouldn't be allowed to change. But really, I think the intermediate goal is to at least understand the effects of changes and to make it more transparent who's done what. So we could explore several different provenance models, as also kind of calling back to Deepak's talk. We could do a kind of simplistic data flow-based or where provenance-like taint tracking, which is a bit ad hoc, doesn't really provide any kind of solid guarantees, but maybe useful. We could do something that would provide a more solid guarantee, but might be overwhelming in terms of everything ultimately depends on everything else, based on a kind of why provenance or both data and control dependency tracking. We talk a bit about an idea that's maybe intermediate that describes the override history that says, okay, this time server field in the result was originally set by Alice and it got overrided by Carol. And then when Alice makes a change, the fact that the time of the change might be reflected in the provenance too. So you can see, well, there was a change to that, so maybe we'd be careful when we revert this change to make sure that the remote change that was masked didn't break anything. So it's not really clear what the right trade-offs are between exactness and utility here, and it's also not clear kind of what the formal property we want or what the kind of usability property we want is. So just to illustrate, the kind of taint tracking approach would say, well, this comes from, this is the wrong version of this, but this should say Carol for this version. So this would say Carol is responsible for this field. And then if we look at dependency tracking, then since anybody could have said it, right, in some sense the result depends on everybody. And if we look at the override history, we can see that Alice set it initially and then it got set by Carol. Right, so that's just to illustrate. And I think probably something intermediate like this third one is a good way to go, but we haven't really proved anything. So the other kind of set of challenges is more generic. It's that these configuration languages have kind of been developed in a homegrown ad hoc way, and it's not always clear what their semantics even are. So it's similar to the JavaScript issue. We kind of have a reasonably large, complicated set of features that aren't that familiar, and so we need to start out by nailing down what actually happens in the language. And I'm picking on Puppet here because it's popular, but other configuration languages, and in particular LCFG, have similar issues. So at the moment, as a kind of baby step, we're primarily Paul looking at the arguably simpler case of LCFG. And so we're using kind of subversion blame and propagating annotations to see what happens. And this is complicated, of course, by the fact that for convenience, LCFG uses the seed preprocessor, which is evil. So the less said of that about that, the better. But just to kind of wrap things up, I'll finish in a minute. One thing that we've found through this experience is there is actually a kind of moderate scale problem. So a mature configuration file in LCFG, for example, consults 13,000 lines of code involving, a lot of them are blank, so around 7,000 statements, involves combining 268 distinct files, which might be written by 10 or 20 or 30 different people. And a lot of these files are included multiple times. So if you want to explore all branches in the possible configurations that you could get by setting different ifdef parameters, you get a large number of possibilities. So the actual amount of data is not huge, but the number of different ways of building it is. Sorry? This is for a desktop machine, I think. Right, so the final product here is about 5,000 lines. This is the size of the build, the stuff that goes into the build process. And about half of the 5,000 lines is kind of defaults, and the other half is specific things. This is, network configuration. If there's software installed on it that needs configuration. So this is, LCFG is what Edinburgh uses to configure all, at least anybody that doesn't opt out of it, their desktop machine. You know, when you reboot the system, it looks and sees if anything needs to be updated and updates it automatically. All right. So it's not a particularly complicated server or anything like that. It's a normal machine. But it has a lot of boilerplate stuff. So another way to think of it is, you know, /etc has a lot of stuff that is default, right? But you might want to change. And this is including a lot of that kind of stuff. OK, so just to conclude, there is a fair amount of related work, which I can talk about if people ask. So I hope I've convinced you that this is at least an important problem to look at. Providence may be useful for auditing and access control, and we'd like to look at that. But it's really, the talk is really about the problem and not about what I claim is a solution. So in the future, we need to look at understanding the semantics of these languages and defining models and policies that will give us some kind of providence security guarantees. Thank you.